This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello, welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. Today I'm interviewing chartered psychologist Dr. Shonich Anderson, who is the research manager for Tourette's Action, and Helen Eady, who is the information manager for the same charity. Shonich and Helen have written the ACAM topic guide on Tourette's syndrome, and today they'll be giving us an overview on the subject. Can we start with introductions? Shonich, would you like to kick off?
Yes, sure. So my name is Dr. Shonich Anderson, and I am the research manager at Tourette's Action, and I've been there for 6 years, and my role is to support and promote medical and scientific research into Tourette's syndrome. I'm responsible for coordinating all of Tourette's Action research activities, including the annual research grant round, and managing the external peer review for that, monitoring grants, and following up the research outcomes. And I'm the point of contact between Tourette's Action and the researchers, the potential research participants, and the wider research environment. And I'm delighted to be an ambassador for Tourette's Action and to help raise public awareness of how research can help improve the lives of people with Tourette syndrome and their families. And one of my chief aims is to promote the importance of research, investigating better treatment and management, and helping support those living with this condition. So Tourette's Action is the only patient support association in England and Wales for people with Tourette syndrome. We support patients, but we're happy to support professionals and teachers and anybody that wants to get in touch who have questions about Tourette syndrome. We can supply leaflets, school visits, clinic visits. We have research awards and training for professionals.
Great, and I'll ask you about the research in a little bit.
So I'm the information manager at Tourette's Action, and I've been working with the organisation for the last 8 years. I'm responsible for our digital and print content, and a large part of my job is to work with clinicians to produce information based on the questions and issues that are raised by the TS community.
Okay, thank you. And what prompted your interest in this area?
Unlike other people who work for Tourette's Action, I don't have a direct link with Tourette syndrome. And when I came to the charity, I knew very little about Tourette syndrome, which is what attracted me actually to the position. I started out by working on the help desk and spent the first 6 years of my time at Tourette's Action managing the help desk. And over that time, I've spoken with thousands of individuals and families and have had great insight into the adversaries that people with TS face.
So I became interested in Tourette syndrome when I was working as a research psychologist at Great Ormond Street Hospital. And I was working on a research project about children with autism and their transition to secondary school. But during my time there, I became involved in helping to run psychoeducational groups for children and parents. And I remember before the first meeting when I went along to help with the group, thinking, oh gosh, I've never met anybody with Tourette syndrome before. I wonder what it's going to be like. But ever since meeting the children and the parents, especially on public transport, I can now see those people with tics all over the place, because tics are the main sort of characteristic of Tourette syndrome, and it's far more common than I had appreciated before I became involved in this field.
Right. I'm going to ask you for an explanation about what Tourette syndrome is, and including some of the main symptoms, but before going into that, I think it would be helpful to do some sort of myth busting, because if you ask people what Tourette syndrome is, they think it is associated with inappropriate swearing. That tends to be what people assume Tourette's is all about. So what is the true picture?
So Tourette's syndrome is an inherited neurological condition. And you're right, there's a myth really surrounding Tourette syndrome that we come up against very often, that it's to do with swearing, and I think that's probably something to do with how it's being represented in the media. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's something that's perhaps interesting to people that are producing programmes, etc. But in fact, of the 300,000 people that we believe to have Tourette syndrome in the UK, we think roughly just about 10% of them have mm-hmm. coprolalia, which is the term for the swearing tic. And Tourette syndrome is made up of tics, so these are involuntary sounds and movements, and they have to be present for at least 12 months to meet the diagnostic criteria. About 85% of people with Tourette syndrome will also have co-occurring conditions, mm-hmm. Which feature and can actually be more problematic perhaps for some individuals than the tics themselves. So that's including things like ADHD and OCD and anxiety and depression.
And just to add to that, it's you know, it's so unhelpful because often when we speak to people who contact our help desk, naturally parents are very concerned and often quite terrified that getting a diagnosis of Tourette syndrome means that their child is going to swear uncontrollably right. in public, mm-hmm. and the ramifications that will have, you know, at school or amongst other family members, socially. So it creates a lot of fear, creates a lot of stigma around mm-hmm. the condition. And we still hear on the help desk that you know, people come to us and say that the professionals they go to, GPs or even secondary care practitioners, still believe that actually having the swearing component of Tourette's is you know, is part of the criteria for diagnosis, which is absolutely not
so
true.
Our help desk service can be reached by telephone on 0300 777 8427. You can also email us help@tourettes-action.org.uk. We also have a live chat service on our website where people can reach us and ask questions, and you can also contact us with any questions through Facebook Messenger.
You said there was set criteria for getting a diagnosis. So what are some of the symptoms, let's say, where you might start to think, well, perhaps this is Tourette's? Mm.
I think parents that we speak to quite often notice that their child is starting to sniff or make noises, and yes, the diagnostic criteria means that they need to have a motor tic and a vocal tic for sort of at least 12 months to meet the diagnostic criteria. And tics are quite common in childhood anyway, and a lot of children will have them sort of on their own, but really when it becomes apparent that some, you know, there are quite a lot of tics and the child might meet criteria for a diagnosis is around the age of sort of 6-7 symptoms start to appear, and around the ages of 11 to 12 there seems to be a peak there, mm-hmm. and that's where perhaps a lot of diagnosis might be made, and children might receive a diagnosis and therefore perhaps a statement of special needs or some help regarding their education as well if the tics are proving to be difficult. But it's really a spectrum disorder, and symptoms can range from mild to severe. Again, in the media, quite often Tourette syndrome is this, the very severe end that's portrayed. But people can have mild, simple tics. They can have any part of the body, any muscle can be involved in a tic, and they can be in simple vocal tics such as whistling or throat clearing, sniffing, coughing, going along to sort of animal sounds or grunting. And especially with the sniffing and coughing, I think that's where a lot of children see a medical professional where they think there might be an allergy, mm-hmm. And they get sort of sent off down the ENT, the ear, nose and throat specialist, mm-hmm. and get referred somewhere where actually that's not where the sniffing and coughing is coming from. It might actually be a tic.
Or going to an optician's because of eye blinking, it's, you know, presumed to be an issue with their sight.
Yes, the motor tics include things like quite often it starts in the head and neck, doesn't it? So eye blinking, eye rolling, things like that. And then more complex tics, so motor tics like jumping, twirling, touching objects, there can be obscene gestures, copropraxia, and repeating other people's gestures, which is echopraxia. And then there can be complex vocal tics, and that's where somebody might have the coprolalia, the involuntary swearing, or repeating phrases, and more complex vocal tics like that.
So what's a sort of typical story in terms of a child getting diagnosed, identified and helped? And I'm assuming it starts with a worried parent. So
yeah,
what tends to happen?
A worried parent tends to go to their GP as the first port of call. And from there, really, it's quite potluck depending on how informed the GP is. So they may be told, if the GP is aware of the criteria of the 12 months of motor and vocal tics, depending on how long the symptoms have been presenting, they may be told to kind of go away again and keep monitoring things and see how they progress. If they're referred from the GP, then they'll typically be referred to a local paediatrician who'll make the initial assessment, and from there either they'll be referred into local service such as CAMHS, or perhaps onto a further specialist in Tourette's, who may be a neurologist or possibly a psychiatrist.
Right. And almost GPs away?
I think that a number of the calls that we get to the helpline are at that point where the parent is worried, they've been to the GP, and now the parent is going to become the expert in Tourette's syndrome and actually gather information from us and find out what is needed for a diagnosis, and what these movements and sounds mean that actually it could be Tourette's syndrome. And quite often they'll take the information from Tourette's Action back to the GP and show them. We also have a list of consultants at Tourette's Action. So these are people who are specialising in diagnosing and treating Tourette's syndrome, and we invite people to take that along to their GP and discuss whether a referral would be appropriate.
You talked
like
about
that.
There being a criteria, but I think I understand that there isn't any NICE guidance.
It's so criteria-wise, as Shonich said, there has to be at least 12 months of multiple motor and vocal tics. But in terms of care pathways and how people are referred into the system, there is no guidance on that at the moment. So I think it's lucky if people find us, if they're struggling at the initial stages, because we can help clarify pathways for them. But that's why it is, unfortunately, so patchy amongst people's experiences. And over 85% of people with Tourette's will have co-occurring conditions such as OCD, anxiety, ADHD, which CAMHS services are set up to support and treat. So, I think, you know, there's mental health in the fact that people can have the co-occurring conditions, but also it's just the impact, the distress that Tourette's can have on a person that can lead to challenged mental health.
Those co-conditions, is that another reason that Tourette's might get missed, though? I mean, does it complicate things in some way?
Yes, it could do. And again, of course, we would, you know, leave it to the clinicians and their clinical judgment as to when they're presented with a patient, what is the most important thing that they look at for that person? What's the most the major problem that they're dealing with? And sometimes it may not be the tics, it may be the ADHD that would be the most difficult aspect. But we recently ran a patient survey at Tourette's Action, and we asked people about their experiences of diagnosis and treatment of Tourette syndrome, and 79% of people that filled out our online survey felt that having Tourette's syndrome has affected their mental health, and 35% of the respondents said that they'd considered suicide or engaged in self-harming behaviours. So those are quite worrying statistics. This is the first time we've run a patient survey, but you know, we're concerned that actually this is something that's being missed. Although it is a neurological condition, it seems very linked in.
And just to clarify, that's the children with Tourette's or their parents?
Well, the survey was filled out by I think mostly parents of children, and adults with Tourette syndrome were also invited to complete it as well. But we found that very interesting results from the survey. Another statistic coming from that was that 49% of people reported that at the point of diagnosis they didn't receive any information, they just had their diagnosis, they weren't given a leaflet or directed towards Tourette's Action, which is the only support association in England and Wales for people with Tourette syndrome. So that's a sort of a point of work going forwards, that we would like people to have that ongoing support and not just have their diagnosis and then be left.
I want to look a bit more at the impact of living with Tourette's on, I assume it affects practically everything, health, social, education, and so on. What's the impact?
I think with regards to education and school, a lot of children actually suppress their tics at school. So teachers don't often see the child as having Tourette syndrome, and that in itself is very problematic, because at home they're really struggling and the school can't see the issues, but obviously it's really impacting on them educationally. So that can be very difficult. And just again, in terms of awareness amongst teachers, there's no official training in Tourette syndrome for teachers or SENCOs. It's something that we're trying to develop and establish some teacher training workshops currently. And so, you know, that in itself is just people don't really know how to manage children with Tourette syndrome in the classroom. And like I said previously, there's a lot of fear around the condition, and people are afraid that if they have a child with Tourette's in the classroom, they're just going to be extremely disruptive and cause lots of problems.
And also, I think sometimes they're perhaps misinterpreting tics as bad behaviour. If you think about the eye-rolling tic in an adolescent in a classroom, a teacher may not understand that actually that child's doing the best that they can to suppress that tic, and it's not a behaviour-related issue at all. And also with suppression of tics, which a lot of people with Tourette syndrome really try to do to manage their tics. If you're trying to suppress your tics while in a classroom all the time, your concentration is really sort of divided. You're spending so much time and energy doing that actually still paying attention to what's going on at the front of the class and perhaps writing at the same time can be really challenging. And I don't think that has often taken into account unless the teacher has some sort of special knowledge about Tourette syndrome, or again, maybe the parents have brought in some Tourette's action leaflets to the school and are spreading the message. I think one of the important things about Tourette syndrome is that we believe it's got the same prevalence as autism. So 1 in 100 school children probably would make a diagnosis of Tourette syndrome. But unlike autism, it really hasn't had the same kind of attention or awareness or even understanding. There's still a lot of stigma around Tourette syndrome, and that it's in some way, especially in the media and on television, there's a sort of comical side that people feel about it, when actually it's far from that when we speak to the patients and the families and their struggles with that and the co-occurring conditions. We have ID cards at Tourette's Action, which we offer to people to use, especially in public transport and in sort of social situations where they're maybe on a train or a bus or something, and people are maybe aware of their tics. And they can tear off one of the cards and sort of just have a few facts about Tourette syndrome to give to people, so that they can sort of spread awareness and understanding of why they're making a noise or doing these movements. And people have found that sometimes helpful.
You talked about children suppressing tics and so on. Can you say a little bit about the management of the condition, and then perhaps go on to some of the ways the condition is treated?
So I think for some of the 300,000 people in the UK with Tourette syndrome, it's a mild condition for them, and they're very sort of happy living with it. The tics don't cause too many problems for them, but of course it's a bit of a spectrum, and those with more severe tics may seek help, and perhaps some treatment options are offered to them at the point of diagnosis, and they seem to sort of fall into two camps. We've got the medication side, where there aren't any specific medications for Tourette syndrome, and there is no cure, obviously. Some of the medications offered can only really help manage some of the symptoms, not having any specific medication for Tourette syndrome means that clinicians are relying on antipsychotic medication that's been used in other health conditions. Also, one of the issues is that parents don't want to put their child, young children, on such medications like this, and there do seem to be quite a lot of side effects as well. So that might be drowsiness, weight gain, irritability, those kinds of things. Along with the other comorbidities or the co-occurring conditions, they may be offered a range of medications, something to manage their ADHD, as well as medication for their tics. But what we're hoping to try and raise awareness about as well is that there's behavioural therapy that can be offered, which can be very beneficial. And with the advancements in telemedicine, hopefully people can access this therapy online as well. So the CBITS training, the Comprehensive Behavioural Intervention for Tics therapy, is found to be very useful, and we offer training in that to clinicians, subsidised training that CANS clinicians can come on and get trained and then treat children with tics in the clinics that they might see. From the research, sort of 4 or 5 sessions of this behavioural therapy can really be helpful with children who have a particularly troublesome tic. And really depending on the tic and the what the clinician decides along with the patient, there are 2 ways of sort of dealing with tics. One might be just to sit with the tic. And what happens before a tic is something called a premonitory urge. And this is a feeling that patients describe as a kind of itch or tickle or sometimes pain that's coming on and really building up towards the moment that they feel they have to do this tic. The clinician can work with the person really looking at how the tic is developing, what muscles are involved, and either sitting with that feeling of the urge until they can, and really letting it abate at the other side and getting used to that uncomfortable feeling to try and manage their tic. Or another kind of therapy that's used is where they're given a competing response. So that might be moving or holding their muscles in a different way so that they don't do the tic. And this is usually used for sort of painful, uncomfortable tics, and they would concentrate perhaps on one tic at a time in that particular therapy.
How effective are the treatments?
Well, the European Society for the Study of Tourette Syndrome, ESTS, has created some European guidelines, and they say that behavioural therapy really should be used as a first-line intervention, and it's something that the parents really seek. They find that it's much preferable to medication in some cases, and we're excited to be helping to promote a study at the moment, a research study where parents and children can join in having online behavioural therapy called the ORBIT study, and that's a multi-centre study. The University of Nottingham and Great Ormond Street Hospital and St Thomas's Hospital, along with other different sites around the UK, are involved, and parents and their children can sign up to that, and hopefully that's going to be quite an exciting way of delivering online behavioural therapy, and therefore being able, people will be able to access it much more freely than they can at the moment, because there's this great shortfall of trained therapists in the UK at the moment.
Right. Well, there was the statistic from our Tourette's Matters survey that quite a significant number of people weren't offered behavioural therapy when they from their consultant, medication was by far the first line of treatment.
Yes, I think it was 61% of people that filled out the survey said that they didn't feel that they had a treatment choice at all.
It wasn't an option.
Absolutely.
And this comes down to what, clinicians not being aware that there are other options? Or
I think it's a complicated picture, and I think that's where we would be keen to work with clinicians and hear from CAMS, especially in regards to the clinical pathways that we'd like to look at for this particular condition. I think it's down to a number of issues, really, that whether CAMS is set up to see children with tics and Tourette syndrome, whether they have the staff and the resources, whether they have the trained individuals. We're very happy to subsidise training and offer that. But really, I think that's where the meeting of CANS clinicians and the charity can come together and hopefully work together towards defining some clinical pathways or looking at the NICE guidelines together to work work out what's going to be best for the patients going forward.
And you've talked about this issue of is it neurological, is it psychological? What is actually known about the causes?
So it's a genetic inherited condition. Quite often I think we find that there's a family member perhaps with some tics or even with some OCD in the in the relations of the picture, and it makes it more likely for the child to perhaps have a diagnosis of Tourette's syndrome. Unfortunately, it's a complicated picture. There isn't one single gene involved at the moment that we know about. It seems to be several parts of several different genes involved.
And also some brain structures have shown up to be different or different in size in patients with Tourette syndrome. So structurally in the brain, there are differences as well. But there's no kind of one thing you can pin it on. Obviously, environmental factors can play into the picture as well.
Yes, problems during pregnancy and birth-related problems, complications have been linked in the research. But again, we need much more research into this area for us to be more sure of these relationships as well. And you're mentioning brain structure and also the neurochemistry as well. There seems to be a function of neurotransmitters, dopamine and serotonin being involved, and those neurotransmitter systems being different in the brains of patients with Tourette syndrome too.
What new lines of research are happening then? Because clearly there's a lot of exploration still to be done.
So there's quite a few brain scanning studies, again, looking at those abnormalities that might be picked up in neurotransmitters or in brain structure as well. But also, Tourette's Action has a research award scheme, and we're very keen to fund studies which look at the treatment and management side of Tourette's syndrome as well. So we're currently funding a study from the University of Kent about stigma as well, which seems to be a really important issue for a lot of people with Tourette's syndrome, and affecting every aspect of their life, whether that's school or employment and their social relationships.
People can
well.
Find out about any of the research projects that we're supporting on the Tourette's Action website. There are links there and descriptions of each of the studies, as well as videos of the researchers themselves talking about the study, and that's at Tourette's-action.org.uk.
We've talked about stigma. Is there any evidence of discrimination in terms of employment prospects?
I would say certainly the people who contact us definitely feel that they're stigmatised at work, and they feel, a lot of people actually feel unsure as to whether to disclose their condition to their employers or potential employers before interview, because they feel it will really work against them. So obviously there is a lot of discrimination there. But I think at the same time there are a lot of positive stories, a lot of positive employers who are setting great examples, and usually it's just a few adjustments that need to be made in the workplace to accommodate that person, or just a general transparency really, an ability to just approach the person with Tourette's and have a conversation about what's going on and what their needs are. Again, there's a lot of fear around, should I mention that I've noticed their tics, or will they be offended? And everyone obviously is different, but I'd say in the majority of cases, most people with Tourette's will say they want to be asked. You know, they welcome questions, obviously, as long as it's done with, you know, good intentions and sensitivity.
And there's lots of positive employment stories we have as well. We have videos on the Tourette's Action website of people who are working and very successfully. There's a great video of a barber from New York who works in a
barbers doing close shaves, the sort of old-fashioned shaves with a razor. Mm. And that might be perhaps the last person that you would think would be doing something right. like that, somebody who has a movement disorder. But he has a very loyal clientele, he's very popular, and that's one of the really positive stories that we try and promote and say, look, you know, yes, you do have Tourette's syndrome, but that shouldn't limit your employment opportunities. Again, going back to the Why Tourette's Matters survey, we do find that people feel that they are discriminated against. 69% of people in the survey felt that they'd been discriminated against, whether that would be bullying or removed from a class in school or suspended and being excluded due to their tics. And that can be a great source of frustration. And 55% of people filling out the survey said that they felt the stigma surrounding having Tourette syndrome affected their mental health. And 78% reported that they felt that Tourette syndrome negatively impacted their school experience or education. So that's a very high number, worryingly. Mm-hmm. And we need to sort of increase awareness and acceptance, I think, generally for the general public, and get away from the stereotype and myth about it being swearing, or that these people are strange, or that there's something to be worried about, when actually, when you explain what it's about, people are much more understanding and accepting.
Yeah.
So schools have a big role, do they? Because it sounds like the issue isn't just teachers not understanding, but also obviously children's peers.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. And again, in our experience, part of our services is that we go into school, we have volunteers who can go into schools and provide presentations, both for the whole school, but also for staff specifically. And people report back to us that once a child is able to freely talk about their Tourette syndrome amongst their peers, they definitely have a much more positive experience, because there is that understanding and acceptance that's generated, rather than, unfortunately, a lot of children will try and hide their Tourette's, and that causes more stress, and the stress exacerbates the tics, and it's like this negative cycle that happens.
I understand tics tend to peak between 10 and 13 years of age, with a reduction for most individuals as they reach adulthood. But we've talked about employment prospects in adulthood, so is it a case that children ultimately grow out of Tourette syndrome, or is it that it's better managed? Can you sort of unpick that for me?
Yes. I'm not sure we can say definitely, but yes, we do think that around 50% of children and adolescents with Tourette syndrome, by the time they get into their early 20s, they're either able to manage them themselves better, so suppressing or managing, or that the tics themselves have eased somewhat. And we're not exactly sure why, and hopefully research will tell us a little bit about why that would be. But we often sort of find, looking at the research that's been done so far, that the adults that are left with their Tourette syndrome are often sort of more at the severe end of the spectrum, with the more sort of comorbidities or co-occurring conditions, and they will have their Tourette syndrome sort of in a lifelong capacity, really.
Will that apply even where they've had some kind of intervention?
Yes, the interventions, the behavioural therapy, are really about managing the tics. And one of the important issues that we haven't mentioned so far about tics is that they wax and wane, so they come and go. So they will sort of cycle through. Somebody may have an eye-rolling tic, and then it might change to something else. And this makes the treatment of Tourette syndrome slightly more complicated. For example, if you give a medication and then you just happen to be on a sort of down slope of the cycle where the tics are going to naturally dissipate for a while and get less, it's unclear as to whether it's the medication having an effect, or whether you're just sort of tapping into that part of the cycle.
And are there certain triggers then that make symptoms more frequent or more extreme?
I think people would definitely say that stress has a part to play there. So if an individual is stressed, they it can really feed into that cycle.
But also, you know, in regards to people's tics, when we find when people are engaged in an activity and they're really focused, you know, their tics can disappear completely. And, you know, a lot of people report playing a musical instrument, you know, being engaged in a sport kind of really focuses their mind and they don't tic, which is quite interesting.
And there's been some research looking at exercise, and that's really found to be helpful. And again, we know this, don't we, that actually in terms of your mental health, exercise can be very helpful and therapeutic indeed. And so we found the same with them with Tourette syndrome, and people's tics actually can ease slightly either during and also slightly longer afterwards as well if they're engaging in exercise. So we definitely encourage people to think about that. We found there's been a slight link in the research between caffeine and tics as well, so perhaps cutting down on chocolate and coffee might be helpful in terms of tic management. But it's very individual, and I think a lot of people use a lot of self-management in terms of things that they find relaxing or distracting or helpful to do in their own sort of self-care. We've recently produced a guided meditation which is available on the Tourette's Action website for people, and this is the first guided relaxation specifically for people with tics with a movement disorder. We sort of felt, why should people with a movement disorder not be able to engage in sort of mindfulness? But it's a challenge for somebody who's constantly sort of moving, and so we've adapted that into the guided meditation, and hopefully that can be used to help people relax or you know, prepare for sleep or use on a daily basis.
Yeah, and relaxation is a component of the behavioural therapy as well, that people are taught those techniques. It seems to definitely have a significant part in helping someone manage their tics.
So there's a lot going on. You've written the Tourette Syndrome Topic Guide for ACAM. Can you give a short summary of some of the themes that you've included in this?
I'd say, generally speaking, it's just a very clear introduction into Tourette Syndrome. We talk about the causes of Tourette Syndrome, and we also talk about treatment options as well. We're also looking at the impact of Tourette's in different areas of somebody's life, and we discuss kind of what's in the pipeline regarding research.
We've covered a lot of ground. Is there anything you'd like to say that I haven't asked, perhaps a takeaway message from both of you for those listening to this podcast?
We're very happy to speak about Tourette syndrome. We're delighted if professionals would like to get in touch with us, and it's really part of our role is to offer ongoing professional support to those clinicians and medical professionals who want to get in touch with us. We're keen to send out information, and we're delighted to be offering subsidised training in the behavioural therapy CBITS. And if anybody would like to look at the Tourette's Action website, they can sign up for training, they can find leaflets there and come along to our clinical consultation sessions as well, which are free sessions that we run in London for behavioural therapists that are seeing people with tics and Tourette syndrome. Again, we want to offer that ongoing support to them after their training as well, and it's really a great chance at peer support and talking about clinical cases and issues like that. I think one of the take-home messages we'd like to raise awareness about is the stigma and the myths around Tourette's syndrome, that actually it's not about swearing, and it's a much more sort of complicated condition. So I'm always posting on social media, and my Twitter handle is at Seanaidanderso2, so that's SEANAIDANDERSO2, and you can also find me on LinkedIn.
And just in terms of patient support, Tourette's Action can offer lots of information and resources. We have lists of consultants who are specialists in Tourette syndrome and a list of behavioural therapists as well. We're also in 2019 putting on four big events. These are family weekend events for people living with Tourette syndrome, which has been funded by Children in Need. And these events are brilliant at getting families and young people together, which really helps to kind of normalise Tourette's. We find that when people are in community, you know, they gain greatly from peer support, and they're just able to be in a free, non-judgmental environment where they can just be themselves and ultimately have fun. So we'll be taking bookings for that in early January. Again, if you go to the Tourette's Action website, people can find more information there.
Okay, and can you give the details of the website?
Yes, so it's www.tourettes-action.org.uk. We've got more information available on our social channels. You can find us on Twitter at Tourette's Action and Facebook at Tourette's Action.
Thank you ever so much, both Helen and Shunich. You can find Dr. Shunich Anderson's and Helen Eadie's topic guide on Tourette syndrome on the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.